Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and today you're listening to an archive edition of our program. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. My guest this hour is Joel Bolger, the former Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. Justice Bolger is a native of the Coon Rapids area in west central Iowa, also a graduate of the University of Iowa College of Law. He joins us this hour to reflect on his path from Coon Rapids to Chief Justice in Alaska, his career as a lawyer, judge, and justice in the largest state in the union. Justice Bolger, welcome to the program. I understand you're joining us from Anchorage. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. Thank you for having me on the show.
And congratulations on your retirement. You retired in June. Very good.
That's correct. It's been great.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners, I understand, Justice, that even though you officially retired at the end of June, you're still wrapping up some loose ends to do with some opinions, and as a consequence, you won't be able to comment on current court proceedings, U.S. Supreme Court opinions, and so forth. I imagine if I ask a question that gets into that area, you can just remind me and we can move on to the next.
That sounds good.
I'd like to start off midlife, later in the program, perhaps talk a little bit about your upbringing in the Coon Rapids area on a farm north of that city. But if you could start by taking us back to the late 1970s when you graduated from the University of Iowa College of Law and tell us how you ended up in Alaska.
Well, I was 23 at the time, and I didn't have a lot of obligations. I had been interested in social justice issues for many years. You can see I grew up in the late 60s and the early 70s, and so social justice was still very important. I heard of a job that was available in southwest Alaska in a small town, fishing town named Dillingham, and so I applied there for a legal aid position. I was a VISTA volunteer, which is similar to the Domestic Peace Corps. So I started my career there doing both criminal public defense work and also legal aid work. We were involved in a program to pursue the applications for native land allotments. Natives were allowed to apply for up to 160 acres based on traditional use and occupancy. So anyway, that's how I started my career, Ben.
Mm-hmm. And what were your first impressions moving from Iowa to Alaska, impressions of the state, the people, and of course that first work as a public defender?
Well, the landscape is a lot different. Dillingham is right on a huge bay, and commercial fishing is the main livelihood compared to a flat landscape with beautiful farms that I was used to in Iowa. But I found that life in a small town was really very similar. A lot of the social activities are revolved around school, like basketball games on Friday night, or attending church on Sunday morning and the like. And so I really kind of fit in a small town in Alaska. It seemed familiar to me after being raised in Coon Rapids.
With your interest in social justice, was the public defender position something that really appealed to you once you did it every day, week after week?
Oh, yes. I enjoyed it a great deal. It was very rewarding. And I think that the mix of cases also kept me very interested because I was doing civil legal aid and pursuing native allotment applications, welfare applications, family law cases at the same time as I was doing these criminal law cases. It was a great way to get experience in a wide variety of legal cases.
Tell me more about what's involved in a native allotment case. What's at stake there?
Well, since 1906, Alaska Natives have been allowed to apply for land based on their use and occupancy. When Congress passed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971, they cut off the program. In other words, no new applications were allowed. But many people at that time had applied for applications that were unresolved. And so it was basically a process of trying to identify the use and occupancy of a particular parcel and to put together evidence, maybe the testimony of elders or other family members who would use the parcel through the years.
And who or what forces were trying to deny that allotment, usually?
Well, the adjudications were from the Bureau of Land Management, and they had contested many of the allotment cases at that time, and it was a source of significant litigation. In fact, while I was working for the Dillingham office, we won a victory that allowed the native allotment applicants to have an in-person hearing to determine their entitlement. But shortly after that, I think in 1980, Congress passed a new law that allowed these applications to be approved as long as there were no private contests over the land. And so a huge number of native allotment applications were approved through that process, and the painstaking work that I did the first 2 years was no longer necessary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's take the next step. I understand, would have been after that, or what was the next step, opening your own law practice?
Well, I went to Barrow, which is now called Utqiagvik, as a public defender for about a year in 1981, and then I came back to Kodiak in 82 and began my own law practice along with partners who had also been in legal aid and public defender work. And I practiced in Kodiak, that is on Kodiak Island, for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. And how far up is Kodiak Island?
Well, it's about 250 miles south west of Anchorage. It's on an island that's 100 miles from the mainland of Alaska. And it's where you hear of the huge Kodiak bears. That's a big part of the lifestyle there in Kodiak.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
it's also an economy that's based on commercial fishing.
Mm, I see. Okay, and when did you set your sights on becoming a judge, or did you make that decision, or was it offered to you at some point?
Well, I had an opportunity to do a great number of different things in private practice, and my firm became heavily involved in the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation. In fact, my partner was one of the trial lawyers for the federal trial in that case. And so that was a significant commitment for me. But after the litigation started to wind down, I started to look for other opportunities, and I decided to apply for a district court position in Valdez, Alaska. And so I was appointed to the district court in Valdez in 1997.
Mm-hmm. When, if it's Alaska or Iowa, another state, what are the qualifications, the criteria for judges? What does a committee or whatever system there is in place look for in a judge usually?
Well, both Iowa and Alaska have systems that are based on what's called the Missouri Plan. I think Missouri may have been the first state to implement this idea, which is that applicants for a judicial position, they have to have minimum qualifications like a certain period of practice or a certain period of residency. And then they apply to a nominating commission. The nominating commission sends names to the governor, and the selection of these nominees is based on their merit, that is, based on their legal ability, their judicial temperament, and other relevant traits. And so then the governor has to pick one of these nominees for appointment to any open position. It's a very fair way to make sure that appointments for judges are based on merit and not on politics.
So are Alaska and Iowa sort of outliers there in the country?
No, there's several states that have similar systems, but there's also a significant number of states that decide their judicial positions by elections, some by nonpartisan elections and some by partisan elections. I forgot to mention one other thing about the Alaska and Iowa systems, and that is the judges face a retention election after a certain period of service. So the voters do get to weigh in on the question of whether a judge will continue to serve.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that came into play in 2010 in a big way in Iowa when three justices were not retained after the 2009 same-sex marriage ruling here in Iowa. Is that pro forma, usually the retention of judges in Alaska, as it is in Iowa, with that exception I noted?
Yeah, I think you would have to say it is, but I think you'd have to say in Iowa and Alaska and other places, these retention elections are becoming more political. They're gaining more interest of groups that will contribute money to try to defeat a judge based on certain judicial decisions. We've had two or three of those cases here in Alaska, and it's a concerning trend.
Mm-hmm. And our Supreme Court justices here in Iowa, as a result of what happened in 2010, have, we've noticed one strategy, becoming more transparent, even taking court proceedings on the road so that the public may observe, doing a better job of making the case for what the judicial branch is all about. Similar things in Alaska that you don't just recognize this as something, the retention that's going to be happened, but make sure people understand the role of the judicial system in each state.
Absolutely. And I would say that court proceedings have always been very public. In other words, until COVID started, we were able to walk into any courtroom in the country and just watch most types of proceedings. And I think if citizens did that, they would understand how judges strive to reach fair and impartial decisions in every case. But you're absolutely right. Since the retention elections have become more political in Alaska as well as Iowa, we've taken more care to make sure that these proceedings are transparent. We've issued press releases. We've taken the Supreme Court to travel to different locations. And generally, we've tried to make judicial proceedings more available to the public.
If you've just joined us, Joel Bolger is my guest. Justice Bolger is an Iowa native, former Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court, grew up in the Coon Rapids area. Well, Alaska is so immense. Tell us how the court system there is different than here in Iowa, merely because of the amount of space, the relatively few people per mile there.
Well, I think there's one difference between Alaska and the rest of the country, and that is because there is no road system to most towns and villages. We have allowed remote access to judicial proceedings as a routine matter, even before the coronavirus. So imagine Alaska has over 200 remote villages, you know, with a population from a few dozen up to 1,000. And most of these villages are not accessible by roadway. You have to either charter a plane to fly in, or during the summertime, maybe you can go in by boat, maybe snow machine in the wintertime. But most of these places, people find it very expensive to travel to a regional center for a court proceeding. That's why most of our courts allow telephone participation for maybe 20 years, more than that. That's really been a very routine thing.
Mm-hmm. And so Alaska was ready in that sense for COVID. Remote distance working was not anything new.
Yes. I would say that we didn't have to get over, what you would say, any adverse opinions about remote participation. But we did have to gear up to participate by video conference. We had to buy microphones, cameras, and software to set up our judges across the state, because sometimes You need to be able to see a witness or a party in order to make a good decision in a court proceeding. And so that was a significant challenge at the beginning of the pandemic for Alaska and for cases nationwide.
Justice Bolger, tell us about the jump from becoming a district court judge to joining the Alaska Supreme Court. How long did that take?
I was a district court judge, which is in Alaska, a court of limited jurisdiction, for 6 years in Valdez. And then I was a superior court judge for 4 years, again, in Kodiak. A superior court judge has jurisdiction very similar to a district court judge in Iowa. And then in 2008, I was appointed to the Alaska Court of Appeals. It is an intermediate court of appeals, but it hears only criminal cases in Alaska. I served there for a little more than 4 years, and then I was appointed to the Alaska Supreme Court in early 2013. Each step of the way, I felt like I gained good experience in order to judge various different kinds of cases, and so I basically just worked my way up the ladder of judicial positions in Alaska.
When you're on a district court or an appeals, a court of appeals, or the Supreme Court, what is the key to working effectively with your fellow justices?
Well, I think you have to be willing to compromise. I think you have to be willing to listen, most of all, and to see things from various different viewpoints. I think one beauty of the justice system is that justices come from a variety of different backgrounds, and I think the system is healthier because of that. I think we should encourage diversity in the judicial selection process and in the bench and bar in general. And so anyway, it's just a process of listening to others and trying to reach a sensible decision. You know, people that serve on a board of directors or other group decision-making processes probably have a similar experience.
How diverse is Alaska's Supreme Court, the justices?
Well, we have had women justices on the court for many, many years. I think, I don't know, over 30 years, I guess. But we have not had a lot of justices from the minority communities.
Okay. You have written, I understand, hundreds of opinions as a justice on the Alaska Supreme Court. I wonder if any come to mind as especially memorable that maybe you struggled with or had a particular impact on Alaska society.
I think that I had a case involving the Ketchikan Gateway Borough and school funding that basically affirmed a process of school funding that had been in place since statehood, and that was a very important case to me. Otherwise, I would say that some of the most important cases are the ones that don't get headlines, the cases involving child custody or child neglect or abuse when the state has to come into the picture. Those cases are so critical, but they're also very difficult because emotions run very high.
How many justices are on the Alaska Supreme Court?
Five justices.
Five of them. How often is the court split 3-2?
Not very often. Most of our cases are unanimous.
Mm-hmm. Any other memorable cases that come to mind of those, well, hundreds of opinions that you wrote, but many more hundreds that were written by your fellow justices?
I don't really think that I have any that I want to mention at this time. They're all important, and I really am very grateful for the ability to have been part of the process for many, many years.
I wonder if you make a decision with your fellow justices, perhaps you are write the opinion of that decision. Do you then years later or more immediately then see the outcome of that decision in Alaska? I mean, I'm just looking for the point of satisfaction that may actually come years later when you say, you know, that wouldn't have been the case if not for the high court deciding, and I am part of that high court.
Right. I think that's exactly true, but I think it's not like one case sticks out to me at this time. It's mm-hmm. like the whole, you know, I think I've authored 450 published opinions. I think that I am just pleased with the way that I tried to make narrow decisions, fair decisions, and explain things in a way that was reachable by the average citizen.
Mm-hmm. You say narrow decisions. Do you, I mean, there's so many descriptors of how judges and justices rule these days. Do you have a way of describing the way you see the law and interpret the law?
I think that my idea is that if judges make decisions based on the facts at hand, without concerning themselves with making rules that will be of broad application, that the law will develop naturally in the way that is most appropriate, because sometimes it's that urgency that is the necessity to make a decision under a certain set of facts that leads a group of justices to the correct decision.
Mm-hmm. And the danger, the risk you see in making overbroad rulings, not narrow?
It's difficult to envision exactly how the decision will apply under all facts and circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a lot
of... And so it may have unintended consequences, Ben. That's what I mean.
Right. I see where you're going with that, but it makes me think that there may have been cases earlier on in your career that you ruled on, perhaps wrote an opinion on, and then looking back, I should have been narrower in that opinion. Do you have those in your background as well?
I suppose that I do, but I can't think of any at this point.
Okay. We'll talk about more about other aspects of your work. There's certainly a lot of it. We want to talk about Coon Rapids, growing up in Coon Rapids, also the University of Iowa College of Law, where you studied. Very quickly before we go, why retire now? You're in your mid-60s.
Oh, I've been with the Alaska court system for 24 years, and I just finished my term as the Chief Justice. I decided that it would be a good time to retire and try to find something new.
Okay. Justice Joel Bolger is with us this hour. Just retired from the Alaska Supreme Court as its Chief Justice. He has Iowa roots in the Coon Rapids area. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with this Iowa native who ascended to Alaska's highest court. After we take a short break, back with Justice Joel Bolger in just a moment. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This hour, my guest is Iowa native and former Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court, Joel Bolger, retiring from Alaska's High Court in June of 2021. So almost wrapping up all of the loose ends to do with that position. And Justice Bolger, you mentioned that you retired. You wanted to have some other things to do in your life. It seemed like a good time to retire. I wonder, do you think there should be term limits or age limits for all of our justices?
I don't think that term limits is a good idea. I think the system that Iowa and Alaska have, which involves retention elections, has worked pretty well over the years. Alaska has a mandatory retirement age of 70. I don't know what the situation is in Iowa. I guess I don't have any particular problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go back to your childhood. Growing up, I understand, in a farm north of Coon Rapids in the west central part of the state. Tell me about your earliest memories growing up in Iowa.
Oh, it was pretty idyllic. I think that farm kids in Iowa usually have a pretty good lifestyle. I went barefoot in the summertime, and I can remember learning to work in the bean fields and detasseling corn and baling hay and things like that. It was a small town, so that all the kids had an opportunity to participate in school activities, and my parents encouraged all of my brothers and sisters to get involved in music and speech and athletics. And so I just feel like I had a great opportunity there. And it really gave me, I think, a sense of responsibility and kind of a flexibility to meet challenges as they came. When you live on a farm, maybe far from town, you can't run to get a new part or to consult an expert every time something goes wrong. There's a lot of things that even a kid has to do for themselves. And I enjoyed growing up that way.
When do you recognize in your life the earliest point at which you thought, maybe law is something I'd like to study?
You know, I think I was interested throughout high school. But when I was a senior in high school, my football coach offered me the opportunity to go with him to Iowa City to meet with a professor there, his old high school teammate, Professor Mark Shantz. And so we went up on a Saturday morning, and I had a chance to meet with Professor Shantz before the football game. I was really impressed by his warmth and his sincerity and his commitment to the rule of law. I think that's the time when I really felt like it was a serious aspiration and I could go into law with the hope of doing some good.
So it was that chance. If not for that chance meeting or that chance visit, would you have found law, do you think?
I don't know, but I don't think it's uncommon for people in Iowa to take that kind of care with someone who has an interest. And so I guess I didn't find it unusual at the time, but I was very grateful for the opportunity.
You've dedicated your life, your career to social justice. Does that trace back to your upbringing in Coon Rapids?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think you would have to say there's also limited opportunities to encounter diverse cultures. At least there at that time, there wasn't a lot of diversity in rural Iowa. But I think that just the openness to new ideas and the sense of responsibility, that is something that has kept me interested in social justice and also in basically just seeking justice, trying to find out the just answer to an individual case or to a problem in general.
With your decades of experience on various courts and Alaska's High Court, how do you see, it's sometimes called an arc, a justice? Do you see that in your lifetime, in your working lifetime, social justice taking steps this way and that, but overall being in a much better place than we were, you know, in the 70s when you decided to go to the University of Iowa College of Law?
I think that is true. I think there are always challenges for the justice system, and I think there's always challenges for individuals. But I think that we've come a long way in delivering access to justice for various individuals and a fair approach for a diverse community of individuals. These things have come a long ways. I also want to encourage anyone listening who is thinking about becoming part of the justice system. as a prosecutor or an attorney or even a law enforcement officer. I think that just the pursuit of justice provides its own reward. At least it's been a very rewarding career for me.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of portrayals on TV shows, cable TV, and so forth. Are there misconceptions while you're encouraging people to get in the area of work and justice? Are there misconceptions you run into again and again, perhaps ones you had yourself?
I think the only thing that I think is a little bit funny is the way that lawyers will have ex parte conversations with the judges on television programs, because that doesn't happen in the real world. There's strict rules against that sort of thing. Yet on TV, it seems to happen all the time.
Yeah, it has a feeling of a backroom deal behind closed doors. And that is not allowed in any state system or the federal system?
Absolutely not. It is goofy to portray the system that way. Judges take care to avoid that kind of contact with attorneys and parties who are before them. It's not a backroom deal. It's more like the umpire standing behind the plate, calling balls and strikes.
Mm-hmm. But the attorneys on each side approach the bench and have a private conversation. That is, I mean, that's another thing we see in TV shows. That does happen regularly.
That does, but that is usually you invite both attorneys up. You wouldn't invite one attorney up to the bench to have a private discussion. You invite both attorneys so that both sides have a fair chance to argue any particular issue.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. If you've just joined us, Iowa native, former Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court, Joel Bolger, with us this hour. Justice Bolger, we've been through a tumultuous election in 2020 and its aftermath, where many state entities, including state courts, had to rule on many claims of voter fraud, and many instances where former President Trump tried to get state officials to change the outcome without any basis. What are your thoughts on how our system held up, particularly, of course, our judicial system in this stress test, when it was really looking like we could be facing a really uncertain future?
Well, I would say this. I don't know the facts of any particular case. All I know is what was reported in the news media. But I think it is significant that individuals were able to bring these cases to court across the country and get adjudications in a timely manner. And I've heard no concern that there was any unfairness involved in the state courts. It just gives me renewed faith that the court system is the place where these disputes need to be decided, in a place where a judge can sort out the facts and apply the law independently without political concern and come up with a decision on any particular issue. And I think the prospect of these election cases being decided across the country very short order is something that just shows that we have a system that works.
Mm-hmm. I think it showed to a lot of people, perhaps you disagree with it, that the American form of government is more fragile than they thought. Has the 2020 election, its aftermath, changed your view of the durability of the American form of government?
You know, I think that a study of American history is necessary in order to get into that question. But I would say, while these events have been very concerning and maybe a test of the various parts of the system, there have been challenges to our system before, throughout our history, times when the president tried to disregard the decisions of the courts or the will of Congress, or times when Congress tried to do things that would affect court decisions. And I would say that overall, the American system of justice has so far stood up to each challenge And I'm proud of the way that the system has stood up to the challenges over the past year.
Why do you believe then that so many people, why do you think it is that so many people believe the false claims of massive voter fraud, have such a distrust in our government institutions, the people that run them, when there is zero evidence of massive voter fraud in any of the states that were named?
Well, I think that is more in your field of expertise than mine. I really don't know why these things happen any more than the average person. And I do know that there are challenges to the integrity of the system. I'm just saying that, at least from my experience in the state court system, that we have a good system of three branches of government that has so far stood up to this stress.
Mm-hmm. Are there trends that you've noticed during your career, Justice Bolger, that especially concern you, apart from what I mentioned there in the election, other trends that you see perhaps even long-term as concerning or especially pleasing, I guess? Let's throw that in there as well.
Well, I think that over the past year and a half, since we've been dealing with the coronavirus, that state courts have come up with a variety of ways to allow people access to justice that will be less expensive and less time-consuming. Video conference proceedings, filing pleadings by electronic means and the like, these things have all accelerated during the pandemic, and I hope that they are trends that will continue. Concerns. I think that we have to continue to address the feeling that you have mentioned, that people are somehow shut out of the system, and I think that probably transparency is the best way that we can do that. I'm also concerned about the politicization of judicial elections, and particularly the recent politicization of retention elections. I think that is something that is a matter for concern, but I think that probably things will work out. I think I just have great faith that we have a good system and that we can address these challenges as they come.
Mm-hmm. Of course, what's new, what's very different than when you started your legal career, your law career in the 1970s, is our media environment, the digital age, 24/7, constant news streams, social media. How do you see that changing the justice system? How does the justice system have to adapt to so many sources of information and news, and some of them really siloed in a certain direction?
I think that the court system should be involved in providing information via various social media. At least in Alaska, we've tried to gear up over the past several years to allow judges to have Facebook pages or Twitter pages and the like, and to comply with the ethical restrictions on that type of media. I think that probably, you know, I do have a strong belief that the better ideas will prevail, and that justice is something that can be pursued through the social media and other modern means, and that eventually the right result will come out.
Mm-hmm. What advice or life lessons would you perhaps like to share, not just for those seeking a law career? As you mentioned earlier, some of the attributes of a person you can be successful in a variety of areas if you have certain attributes. What would you like to share for younger listeners, perhaps searching for a meaningful career path?
Oh, golly, that's a heavy question. But I guess I would say to just stay open-minded, and to think about what's available, and to think about a way that you can help other people and contribute to society, and not just be limited by your own personal financial progress.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you grew up in the 60s and 70s. What are your thoughts about the challenges of growing up in this day and age instead of the 60s and 70s? You ever sort of say to yourself, as many of us do, what if I had been a kid today? Do kids have a tougher time now finding their careers?
I don't know about that. I think there's a lot available to kids today that was not available to me. And especially I think that through media that kids are exposed to a much wider variety of experiences than I had the opportunity to be exposed to it in my youth. So I can't think of anything negative about that. I think that probably the more information, the better.
Mm-hmm. Are you a big user of digital media, social media, and so forth? Do you have your phone with you all the time, checking for news updates or anything?
I do follow the news on the phone, and I had an official Facebook page for a while until people tried to contact me ex parte through the Facebook page, something that I had not anticipated, and I never was able to come up with a real good technical fix. But now that I'm retired, I'm active on social media also. And so I think it's enjoyable, a fun part of life. I know that there are destructive parts of that system also, but so far I enjoy it.
You're in your mid-60s, retiring. What's out there? Have you figured out what's out there? What's your next thing?
Oh, so far I haven't really pushed myself too hard. I've enjoyed volunteering at the local food bank, and I think I probably will get into more types of volunteer work, either through the court system or maybe through pro bono work in legal aid.
Mm-hmm. You have so much spectacular wilderness up there in Alaska. You grew up in a rural area here in Iowa. That's been a constant in your life, the love of wildlife and wilderness, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, and I still enjoy fishing. I don't get to go fishing as much as I want to, but now that I'm retired, I can go whenever I want to, and so I think I'll probably pursue that more.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any interesting encounters with wildlife in Alaska while you've lived there?
Oh, I think everyone in Alaska does. During my first year here, I had encounters with bear and moose, and we still have encounters every day. I have moose passing through my yard all the time. I went on a bike ride with a friend just the other day, and a black bear ran across the trail right in front of us, right in the middle of town. And so that stuff is kind of cool and interesting, but we also carry bear spray and an air horn just to make sure that those critters don't get too close.
I understand, Justice Bolger, you were also caught in an avalanche at one time. Can you tell us quickly about that?
It wasn't a huge avalanche, probably about 500 feet down, but a friend of mine and I were cross-country skiing, and we decided to climb up over a mountain. And when we were walking on what we thought was a rocky ridge, it turned out to just be a cornice, that is, a snow and ice cornice that wasn't supported. And we fell right through and went a ways down the mountain. I had a good grip on my skis, and so I felt like I kind of floated down. I was very lucky. My partner got banged around a little bit, but at least he came out on top and we were able to retrieve his belongings. So that was something that made me much more careful. As I spent more time in the backcountry, I took an avalanche course a few years later.
Mm-hmm. And your future includes a lot of enjoying more wilderness such as that after your retirement. Mm-hmm. Well, after you finish up your... Yeah, okay. How often do you get back to Iowa? When was the last time?
I was back, sadly, for a funeral in Glidden last spring, and I don't get back enough, probably every 1 or 2 years.
Mm-hmm. What do you like to do most of all when you get back? What do you like to soak up here in Iowa that you don't have necessarily in Alaska?
I like corn on the cob, and so anytime I have a chance to have a corn on the cob or fresh pork, fresh beef, fresh tomatoes, all those things that come along through the farm system in Iowa, I think they're just great, just delicious. I mainly just visit family and friends when I'm here. I can't think of any particular activities that I do, but mostly just visiting.
Mm-hmm. And the University of Iowa College of Law, we didn't get a chance really to speak of it, but fond memories of the faculty who shaped your career, shaped your learning.
Oh, yes. Early on, I was part of a small class, and I had a chance to have great experiences with some great professors like Professor Arthur Bonfield and Professor Al Vestal. I also had a chance to be part of the Prisoner Assistance Clinic, and I worked with great professors there like Bob Clinton and Bob Bartels. And it just formed a basis for me to pursue the dreams that I talked about, the dreams of coming to Alaska and working in a legal aid public defender office.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us this hour, Joel Bolger, retired Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court, Iowa native from the Coon Rapids area. It's been an honor. Thank you for spending the hour with Iowa Public Radio listeners, Justice Bolger.
Thank you, too, Ben. I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I hope you have a great day.
You, too. Thank you so much.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
River to River, produced today by Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.